Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.
Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Weekend Preview Podcast. I am joined once again by Quint Kostnick, once again on the horn. How you doing, buddy?
Doing great. You know, mid to late April, got the tulips in the garden. I had to mow the lawn twice this week, and we got major big-time lacrosse games. Major League Lacrosse draft Wednesday night. You know, I remember I put it on my calendar like months ago, thinking, wow, that's a long time from now. And all of a sudden, it's here and gone. What a great night at US Lacrosse. A lot of, you know, big name people there, from Miles Harrison to you know, Steve Stenerson to the new commish. I was very impressed with a lot of owners, presidents, GMs, and coaches of the franchises. Just a great evening.
I agree. I was in attendance as well. I was not working. I was schmoozing, rubbing elbows. And, you know, for the kids out there, spent a lot of time talking to Greg from East Coast Dyes. But it's a good venue for that. You know, it was interesting because the last couple of years, well, last year it was at Final Four in a restaurant. A couple of years prior to that, when it was in conjunction with the U.S. Lacrosse Convention, it was in a hotel ballroom. And in those instances, it was, you know, kind of commingling between the draft executives, so the team executives that were working, and the public. In this instance, you know, basically fans in attendance were downstairs. The draft was happening upstairs. You guys were broadcasting from the museum. But everything worked pretty well, I thought. It flowed pretty nicely. That room where the draft occurred was a little tight, and I wonder how much it impacted the prospect of trades or communication between team executives for fear of being overheard. I thought that was kind of an
good
interesting
point.
Wrinkle.
Yeah, I loved having it at US Lacrosse, and for a lot of people in attendance, it was the first time they had seen that facility. You know, I had been given a tour by Jody Martin, and I recommend it if you're you know, in the area, swing by the Hall of Fame is where Evan and I were stationed. I would have preferred to be on the floor in and amongst the coaches and GMs, you know, almost dealing with it like it was a game show and dealing, you know, getting right up into their face before a pick and asking them questions. And that I'd like a much more raw television product. But, you know, for me, I was standing there. I was looking at that Hall of Fame wall with all sorts of guys who had scored a lot of goals on me. So it was kind of humbling.
Before moving on to the actual selections, one note I want to make is I did feel the absence of Dave Huntley. Talking with IL analyst Kyle Devitt, he remarked at how humorless the room seemed in comparison to prior years. And there are probably a lot of reasons for that. You know, the stakes of this draft, the close proximity, like I talked about, the presence of a new commissioner, presence of a new owner, as a new owner for Atlanta was announced last night as well. You know, but I do think that Dave Huntley brought a lot of levity to every room that he entered, and the draft was no different. So just another reminder of how much a bummer it is to have lost him too soon.
Yeah, I agree with you. He was always able to create humor in any kind of scenario, and you know, was the room tight? Yeah, maybe a little. It was such a small room that it was hard not to be, you know, guarding your materials. And I mean, I got to a point in the draft, Terry. You know, I had a list of short stick defensive midfielders that I had gotten by myself, and then with some help with some coaches, and I didn't feel that like during round one and round two I should give out my list because I thought it was kind of proprietary and I didn't know, like, wait a second. That's my job to say who I think is going to be drafted. But then I'm giving away proprietary information to someone who may not have done their work. You know what I mean? So I was in a little bit of a bind there.
Well, let's talk about the selections. Trevor Baptiste was taken number one overall. No surprise there. The only surprise is that the Boston Cannons held on to that pick. They weren't able to trade and acquire more assets, which took a lot of people by surprise. The Atlanta Blaze chose Connor Kelly number two. Connor Fields went number three to Charlotte. The Dallas Rattlers executed the first trade of the draft, acquiring the fourth pick from the Chesapeake Bayhawks, and they took Ben Reeves. The New York Lizards selected Joel Tinney number five. The Bayhawks received the number six pick in that draft in addition to the 42nd selection, and they took Denver longstick midi Sean Mayle. Jules Hennenberg, a Florida native, went number 7 to the Launch. Connor Keating, Penn Lostick midfielder, went number 8 to the Outlaws. And the defending champion, Ohio Machine, to Justin Gutterding at number 9. What were your reactions to the first round selections?
No big surprises, quite honestly. We felt that the top 4 were going to exist in some kind of order, with Baptiste and Kelly being 1-2 or 2-1. Fields and Reeves had to be next. And then there's a little bit of a drop-off. You know, Tinney went high. I'm guessing that Rabel made a couple calls to Spallina after seeing Tinney with all sorts of assists this year. And then, you know, I can look at Tinney at 5 and then drop all the way down to, let's say, 18, John Sexton, or even below that. And the players are all very similar in abilities. And when I looked at Coach Cottle's analytics with the Chesapeake Bayhawks teams, he had those top 4 guys as, you know, 97, 98, 99 type grade points, and then a drop into the 70s. So I think everyone saw it the same way. I've never been more impressed, Terry, with the overall amount of work that all these franchises. There are years that I walked out of this draft like saying, wow, I'd be the second best GM in the league. Well, now I look at it like, wow, these guys are all doing more work than I am. You know, I do a lot of work for my games. I'm not watching Hartford. I'm not watching Vermont right now as much as I have to. But they're doing tons of work, and it's really, really impressive to actually see now all the franchises rise up and compete, quite honest, with the Dave Cottles and Tony Siemens of the world who can do it full-time.
I'm going to pick 2 nits with the first-round selections. I thought Justin Gutterding falling below 6 was a surprise. I thought that was his floor. I mean, I thought 8 was pretty high to take Connor Keating with some of the guys on the board that I think are going to translate really well to the league. Basically, a lot of these guys that went in the second round, you know, I know that offensive-minded long poles have more value in the MLL than they do in college lacrosse, but at the same time, you know, guys like Ben Randall and Bryce Young and Michael Rexrode have MLL bodies. Kyle McClancy has a two-way skill set that, you know, this is the highest possible comparison, but, you know, one that brings Matt Abbott to mind. So to have Connor Keating taken ahead of those guys was a little bit of a surprise for me.
I like McClancy a lot, but I disagree with you on the defenders. There's not a single close defender who I've watched this year, Ben Randall, Bryce Young included. Bryce Young is not covering, and that's an issue when we talk about Maryland, who's playing Ohio State this weekend, 2:00 on Sunday, ESPNU. Bryce is covering the number 2 attackman for all these teams. Curtis Corley has been covering the number 1 guy. Okay, that's a fact. That's Bryce was injured, missed the first 3 games, has come back. He ain't covering the top guys. Curtis Corley is. Okay, so on his own team, he's not viewed as the number 1 cover guy. And then there's Ben Randall. I mean, I plug in the tape from the Michigan game, and Buchanavich is inside rolling him and taking him to lunch. You know, I haven't seen Michael Rexrode. I watched that Rutgers-Maryland game last Sunday. He didn't really make any plays that jump out at me. I think that the Poles are more charismatic this year, and obviously they're going to be. You know, Sean Mayles just vicious with the ball and a stick. John Sexton is great off the ground. And then Keating can make plays in the open field. So those guys are going to jump off tape. I think this is a very weak class in terms of close defense.
Moving on to the midweek games. 3 this week in men's Division I lacrosse. Yale, 14-4 victors over Marist. Providence, 12-11 overtime victors over Brown. And St. Joe's, 12-11 over Penn in regulation. That's the result that is worthy of note. Penn came into this game at 500, 6-6. They have numbers and quality wins that suggest that they are an NCAA tournament team. However, similar to the position Carolina was in last year, they've got to win. They've got to accrue wins in order to ensure that they finish above 500 and eligible for the NCAA tournament. They've got 1 game remaining against Dartmouth, a presumptive win, and then depending on how, you know, tiebreakers shake out, they're likely to get in to the Ivy League tournament at 3-3. They have to win a semifinal matchup in order to finish above 500. If they do not, then they will not win, or I'm sorry, they will not finish above 500 and not be eligible for the NCAA tournament. So that was a really, really big loss for the Quakers.
Well, I had 2 more points about the draft. Yale had 6 guys drafted. I love that. They're seniors. I think they're going to make a run here. Syracuse had none. When was the last time that Syracuse had no guys drafted?
Never. It has never happened in MLL history.
Correct. So we move on. Let's open our books to the RPI and see what it shows us this week and what stands out to you, Terry. I was really surprised on Monday to see Brown in the top 20. They have since fallen. You know, Denver made no improvements last weekend. They played better. They won, but they're still outside the top 10. Notre Dame hanging strong with a great RPI. Penn, the same deal. Now they're under 500. They're not even in consideration. And then Nova dropping like a rock. What stands out to you RPI-wise as we head into the weekend?
One thing that's worthy of note, I've got my eye on that number one seed conversation, whether or not Albany can hold on. Obviously, Yale at number 7, and then Vermont at number 18, a team that they're likely to play again in the America East tournament. Vermont as a top 20 win for Albany strikes me as meaningful because they've, you know, obviously banked wins over Maryland and Syracuse. And maybe it doesn't become even more complicated than that because, you know, one of the notes that I took away from the NCAA selection committee's top 10 rankings that they shared last week was the perceived or my perception of their importance of head-to-head wins. And so maybe already Albany is already number one with a bullet, but you know, because of their history, that's been a main point of emphasis for me in terms of just thinking about that quarterfinal matchup and who they could get. The notion of two wins over Vermont, you know, getting them to a level where they have, you know, say a 7-0, 8-0, 9-0 record against the top 20, depending on how that shakes out, you know, that's insurmountable if you're another team. So that was one thing. And then the other is Loyola as a top 5 win for the teams that have beaten them, particularly Virginia. You know, Bucknell is an interesting team relative to their bubble status. You know, their RPI is a little low in the 14-15 range right now to warrant serious at-large consideration. But if there is no bid thieving, and they, you know, beat Lehigh this weekend, and win their presumptive quarterfinal matchup if they get one, you know, they might rise to that 12 or 11 territory that puts them in earnest consideration, and all of a sudden that win over Loyola is really meaningful. And then obviously, you know, for Duke's win over Loyola is another, you know, important part of their resume, but it's not that meaningful. But Loyola is a top 5 win for Virginia, and Bucknell is one that I absolutely have my eye on.
Yeah, and then league races are getting interesting to me, you know, with the NEC being such a strong conference this year, with Robert Morris, Bryant, now St. Joe's taking a leadership position there. CAA looks like it's going to be UMass, but you never know. Quinnipiac has the lead in the MAC, and they're headed towards a play-in game with a really low RPI of 52. And then the SoCon, you know, your Richmond squad's back at it. I give you credit. They've rallied here. I've seen the NCAA selection committee top 10 and more for this week. We'll air it this weekend. We have two games that we're televising Saturday. Saturday's noon. It's North Carolina against Notre Dame. We're still waiting to hear what the exact ACC criteria for their league tournament is. The ACC was meeting on Thursday at 1 o'clock, and then Sunday afternoon at 2, it's Ohio State, Maryland, and we will be releasing the NCAA top 10 list.
So before we jump into this week ahead, a couple more items on the news docket that I want to discuss. Last Friday, we learned that Bellarmine head coach Kevin Burns had stepped away from the program. You know, status around that and the details are still unclear. Jay Sotheran has taken over as the interim head coach. Bellarmine is now the third team who this season has had a change in leadership. And depending on how you define this season, I'm including Air Force, despite the fact that they're uncertainty dates back to the fall, but you know, couple that with Holy Cross and Judd Lattimore no longer at the helm there, and then you combine that with two interim coaches this season, Ed Williams at Lafayette and Peter Milliman at Cornell. You know, the amount of, you know, potential turnover this summer is really interesting, and the intrigue and drama, you know, surrounding these head coaching positions. You know, first of all, you know, some of these issues have been personal, you know, in nature, and that speaks to the stress of the position. And we want to emphasize the compassion that you feel for folks that occupy these high pressure jobs. Some of these are a reflection of administrative and parent dynamics, and you know, it underscores how difficult those two issues are to navigate in a modern age. And then, you know, the last, I think, is the notion of competition, both for quality coaches, as well as for quality opportunities. And you look at the situation with Lafayette and Jim Rogalski's decision to take an assistant coaching position at Michigan, and how that has unfolded, you know, now with reports coming out of Ann Arbor that Connor Ford is no longer a part of that staff. You know, it just speaks to all of these inner dynamics that make the world of college coaching pretty mind-filled. And that's why, you know, one of the things that I wanted to discuss with you is how much of a lock is Pete Milliman to become the full-time head coach at Cornell, huh?
Yeah. What's it going to take? I'm an inch away from tweeting, you know, free Peter Milliman. Why is this guy still the interim coach? Could he be doing a better job than he is right now this season? I mean, he's doing a fantastic job. They've got that loss to Yale, and they opened the season with a little setback against Colgate. They're a young team. They have tremendous momentum. They have a dynamic player in Jeff Teat. They only had one senior drafted, Major League Lacrosse, on Wednesday, so they're going to bring back this whole team. And this guy doesn't deserve to be the head coach right now, right here, right now. Like, really? Let's step up.
So it's interesting to me. There are two things at play, just in terms of you and me having this conversation right now. The first is, you know, AD Andy Noel said last summer that he was going to reassess the situation after the 2018 season. What do you lose by waiting till the 2018 season? I guess the biggest risk.
What do you lose?
Is,
well, if you're Air Force, maybe you jump in and you grab them.
That's
if you're
what I was going to say.
Maybe you step up and you grab them. If you're someone else thinking about making a change, maybe you step up and grab them. And then Cornell's playing catch up.
Well, not only that, but then if they do decide to try to retain him, you know, the price goes up. The other thing that's interesting is, you know, there's going to be a lot of influential alumni around the team this weekend as they celebrate the 40th anniversary of their historic winning streak. You know, I'm curious to see whether or not those alums kind of pressure the administration to make sure that, you know, their new head coach isn't going anywhere.
Yeah, I just, you know, I feel like saying that publicly. I may say it in a game this weekend.
Well, you just did.
I don't think it's my place to tweet that out. But, you know, having talked to Kevin Corrigan, Joe Bresci, John Tillman this week, later this afternoon, I'm talking to Nick Myers of Ohio State. You know, to a man, coaching of lacrosse, you know, is the easiest thing that they're doing right now as head coaches. You know, the parental dynamics, the recruiting dynamics, the culture dynamics, the off the field academics, career dynamic. Those are the hard parts of this job right now. The coaching lacrosse is extremely, extremely easy.
Well, then that is the perfect segue. Let's go ahead and talk to a litany of coaches. We will start with Yale's Andy Shea.
Quint, the last time we talked about 4hymns.com, I told you, I confided in you a very deep secret, which is that I'm losing my hair. And you said, I didn't know that I was ready to talk about it. And since then, I've seen advertising for 4hymns.com all over the place, and it's really emboldened me. I am 33 years old, turning 34. And did you know that 66% of men lose their hair by age 35? The thing is, like what happened to me, when you start to notice the hair loss, it's too late. It's easier to keep the hair you have than it is to replace the hair you've lost. So if you start to notice, you know, maybe a little bit of capturing around the drain after a shower, check out 4hymns.com. It's a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, sexual wellness, all tailored to men. Thanks to science, baldness can be optional. Hims connects you with real doctors and medical-grade solutions to treat hair loss. It's basically all those products that have been on the market for years or decades. You can find the generic equivalent of name-brand prescriptions to help you keep your hair. It's not, you know, the stuff you see on late-night TV. This is legitimate, scientifically proven prescription solutions. No waiting room, no awkward visits. Save hours of time and money by going to 4hymns.com. It is so easy. Answer a few quick questions, and a doctor will review and prescribe to you. Products are shipped directly to your door. In order to order, our listeners get a trial month of Hims for just $5 while supplies last. See the website for full details. This would cost you hundreds if you went to the doctor or pharmacy. Instead, go to 4hymns.com/lacrosse. That's forhims.com/lacrosse. 4hymns.com/lacrosse.
The Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Yale head coach Andy Shea, whose teams are coming off of a midweek win over Marist. square their sights on the Albany Great Danes Sunday afternoon, one of the most anticipated matchups of the season. Coach Shea, how do you describe the way in which your team has come together in recent weeks, particularly looking at that huge goal total that you guys put up against Brown?
Right. You know, I think that we are trying to impress upon our guys to play better and work harder in practice. And, you know, we feel like in practice you can work on your individual ability. And, in practice and in games, you can work on the collective and execute properly. And hopefully if we constantly remind our guys of that, we can get better as the season goes on. And, you know, we tend to have upticks and downticks, you know, in the April games. And I think the goal is to have more upticks than downticks. So I think we keep saying it. We remain a work in progress. And I think our seniors have done a really good job of corralling the team and the young guys and just keeping them focused on getting better. So I'm happy with where we are, and this weekend's going to be a huge test, so we'll see.
Before moving on to this weekend, I've gotten an opportunity to see play 5-6 times over the course of the season, and what's interesting is that as Yale positioned itself among, you know, the teams that I would call national championship contenders, you're 10-2, lost your opening game of the season, and I felt like
Right. Until
the Princeton game, that you reeled off 4, 5, 6 wins in a row. Until that Princeton game, it felt like it hadn't put all the pieces together. Did you and your staff feel that way? And if so, you know, despite the setback to Bucknell since, do you feel like over the course of the last month, there's been even more progress?
Yeah, like I said, I think that we are trying to get every individual player better over the course of the season. And we had some guys that, had contributed more in years past that needed to do more things to contribute on certain areas, you know, be it anything, scoring goals or ground balls or whatever. You know, we felt like we needed a little more out of those guys. And, you know, we challenged guys over the course of the year. And I think that what you've seen, you know, is those guys start to step up. We challenged Matt Goddard as a, for instance, and you know, putting him on the bench and playing his buddy there, and his buddy stepped up, and, you know, then Matt earned it back. And so, I give those guys a lot of credit. They didn't blame anybody, either of them. And they just, they fight and they compete. And, you know, in that little intrinsic battle, we've been able to get better. And that's just an example of that corner of the field. I mean, there's been other guys that have stepped up in other areas. So we're definitely impressed with how every guy has reacted kind of selflessly and tried to improve for the team.
Is Ben Reeves the leader of this team? And what more can you say about him?
Yeah. I mean, Ben's our captain. He was voted by his teammates and, you know, in a landslide as a guy that they want to lead them. And he's another one that it's very rare a kid, you know, comes out of the box and understands leadership. And I think it takes a long time for everyone or anyone to get it. And it's not going to show up September 1st naturally for many people. And sometimes it takes till February or late March or even mid-April. And Ben's been a steadying force in terms of, you know, our team chemistry and team unity. And he's had great seniors around him that have added that, have helped him with that. And the guys are, you know, it's late April, even though it feels like it's February, the guys are still practicing really hard and they enjoy being around each other. So as long as that doesn't set in, you feel like you got a pretty good group and you got a good chance.
You're facing off at 60%. You're stopping the ball at 51% in the net. How do you feel like you're performing in those specialty positions?
I would think that it's one thing to say that's a broad number, but if you look at us game by game, we have not been that consistent. And, you know, we've had some injuries. We've had some some situations where we've played other guys and for both positions. So, and once again, I credit our guys for fighting through that and understanding that the end result is hopefully a better position at the end of the day. I think, our goal numbers sometimes are below 50%, sometimes above. And if we can get consistency above, then we're going to be that much better off. And you know, the faceoff X, Connor's having a similar year to last year. He's fighting through some injuries, but we think we got a pretty good strategy to keep him going the rest of the year. He is, once again, he started out similarly. He's, had some struggles early on and really fell into his groove and was playing as well as anyone by the end of the year. So hopefully we can count on that.
About this Albany matchup, the fourth year, the three prior have been one goal losses for your squad. It's an awesome series. Last year under the lights at Casey Stadium was one of the coolest games of the season. What has it meant for you? And particularly in this matchup where your team will be coming off 4 days rest and their team will be coming off about 14 days rest, how does that impact where your head's at heading into this meeting?
I don't know. I think I'll know after the game, but, we purposely scheduled a midweek game this week because we wanted to. I feel like in years past, the Albany game has carried a lot of weight. It's very unique compared to our league slate. And we as coaches maybe tend to put too much into it and overcook it a little bit. So I felt like a Tuesday game would give us an opportunity to not necessarily concentrate every bit of attention on these guys. I think that, Albany and Yale, at the end of the day, probably both just want to play and play a loose style and a freestyle. And that's kind of what we're going to attack it. It's just going to be a game that it's just going to be, hopefully for our fans and their fans, it's going to be a fun game to watch. So if we just play loose and once again, don't overcook it, maybe a little bit different than, the years past where we're planning and planning and planning, and maybe it's a little paralysis by analysis, So they have incredible star power. They always have. So that's one of the things that kind of maybe overwhelms maybe our coaches in the years past. So we're trying not to let that happen. And shortening our week is one strategy. Maybe it's not the smartest, but I guess we'll find out.
I misspoke. They'll actually be coming off of a shorter rest as they play a league contest versus Binghamton on Friday. Last question is just, is there anything about this Albany team that you feel like is particularly unique and or interesting to the 2018 season relative to the three previous meetings?
No, I think that, they're very similar to what they've been. I think that they, they've added pieces to their kind of the Albany brand over the years, and they've gotten better and better and better. And their confidence has gone up, up and up over the years. I'm just really impressed with kind of what they've done. And the product that they have on the field is, they're the number one team for a reason. They're extremely impressive and they play a loose style, which is fun to watch, not fun to prepare for, but they're great in the specialty areas. And they have, once again, they have star power, and big names that are big names for a reason. So I think, It's just impressive, and it's unique. It feel like it's an island in college across that just, came out of nowhere relatively, with all the blue buds. There was Albany a few years ago, started getting better and better, and those guys do a phenomenal job up there. So it's just very impressive.
Well, Andy Shea, we really appreciate your time on the Inside Lacrosse Weekend Preview Podcast. Best of luck as you prepare for the Great Danes, and we look forward to watching that game. For those of you unable to watch live on the ESPN app, it'll be available via tape delay, 6 p.m. ESPNU, Sunday night.
And the Inside Lacrosse Weekend Preview Podcast continues with Loyola head coach Charlie Toomey. His Greyhounds are 9-3 and coming off of a 23-9 win over Boston University, angling for the number one seed and the hosting duties in the Patriot League tournament with the Army Black Knights coming to town. Friday, fun house in the Patriot League. Charlie, thank you so much for joining us. Can you describe the way that your team has rounded into form over the last 2 weeks with four games in roughly 15 days?
Terry, thanks for having me. We've been real happy, you know, with the last couple weeks, how the team has progressed, how defensively I feel like we're getting better, but more importantly, I think both sides of the ball, offensively and defensively, we've seen an uptick, really because the faceoff X has improved, and Coach Vegas has continued to work hard there. Warfice and Bailey Savio have done a terrific job competing in practice and, you know, just pushing each other a little bit better. And we've really tried to make it more of a 50-50 there. And I think that's what we've seen. And when we've done that, we've had the ball a little bit earlier, you know, in some games, and that's taken some pressure off of the defense. And so really that's been the biggest change for us is winning the ball and creating some more 50-50 chances at the X there.
Certainly there's so much about possession that dictates flow, and particularly with an offense as potent as yours, being able to feel that early leads to big goal totals. And, you know, to be on the sideline and watch your offense put up 16 against Lehigh and 23 against Boston University, what does that do for the vibe of the team in total, and how does that parlay itself into the next weeks of practice?
It gives you energy. You know, it gives you energy on the sideline. It gives you an excitement on the field. As I said, it takes a little pressure off of the short sticks to, you know, feel like they've got to get a stop. You know, when you're not winning faceoffs, you got to get a stop every time to go down and play offense. And we just felt like the defense was really taxed. And so when we can win the ball and get it down there, we're watching our offense, you know, really improve. And probably the biggest improvement for our offense has been just in 6-on-6. You know, we used to really want to be a quick strike team. But because we have to come from defense to offense and, you know, really you're on the field so much, it's hard to, you know, when you're not winning faceoffs, it's hard to really want to take that early opportunity chance. So really the development of the 6-on-6 offensive sets that Coach Van's been working with, you know, the offense on, it's been fun to watch. And they are, the spacing is very good. And, you know, obviously Pat's a terrific player, but, you know, I think Pat has improved as guys around him have improved.
Looking at some of the advanced metrics, you're one of three teams in college lacrosse who are top 10 in offensive efficiency and defensive efficiency. And it suggests to me that the compete level probably pretty high in practice. What's it like when the number ones go against each other? Which end of the field tends to get the better of it? And, you know, can you describe the hooting and hollering at practice for those who haven't had the pleasure of being there live?
Well, I think, you know, I've been at the Naval Academy and I've watched, you know, ones go against ones and with fist fights and, you know, a lot of energy down there. And, you know, obviously here at Loyola, you know, when the ones go against the ones, there's a lot of pride on the line. And sometimes we even put a little running on the line. So it can get pretty competitive. We have a cheeseburger Thursday where the winning team might get cheeseburgers after practice and just do some fun things. You know, for the guys, but you know, when we go after each other toe to toe, you know, it could be some battles. And, you know, a lot of times it might be if we go on a Tuesday, at least got a lab, he comes out late. So, you know, it's a little unfair cause we might be missing a guy or two due to an injury or holding them out. But, you know, that's been the biggest thing. And to be truthful with you, the captains came to me about 3 weeks ago and said, Coach, you know, we really need to see each other. You know, the ones need to go against the ones, and really we want to compete against each other and prepare us early in the week for what's coming on Saturdays. And, you know, our scout guys do a terrific job of running our opponent's set, but that's more now for Wednesday, Thursdays, and, you know, some early Friday walkthroughs to prepare us for the games. And I think those Monday, Tuesday competitive segments have really helped us on both sides of the ball.
I mentioned you got Army on Friday. It's such an interesting wrinkle to the college lacrosse schedule that the Patriot League, given how large it is, the fact that there's a quarterfinal round that doesn't exist in any other league tournament in Division One, has this event, for lack of a better word, where, you know, there are four games on Friday night. What's that like in terms of, you know, we'll get to Army in a second, but what's it like for you, you know, knowing that there are three other games going on that have, you know, a huge impact or theoretically have a huge impact on, you know, how the next 9 days are going to unfold for you?
Yeah, you know, what we've talked about is that you can only control, you know, what's in your house. And right now that's Army at Loyola. I think it's kind of unique that our league has that many Friday night games. But I also think that as a league, we're kind of unique in that we have nine teams in it. And so we have six teams in the Patriot League tournament. And that means, you know, there's a Tuesday game. And so as a bunch of coaches, we got together and said, listen, we really need to move these things to Friday night to give whoever the, you know, the three through six seeds are a chance on that following Tuesday. You know, it's been tough road for those teams alone, just kind of having to win three games to get the AQ. Got to give those, you know, those teams a chance. And there's so much on the line with all of these games. You're right, Loyola could certainly still be in a position to host, but we could also be in a position to go on the road Tuesday or be at home on Tuesday. So, you know, really what you have to control is, you know, in your house. And for us, that's Army on Friday night.
So the Black Knights come to town. This is the third season with this schedule structure where you play them in the final week of the season. And in the previous two seasons, it's been that you've matched up with them again a week later in the tournament. All four games have gone your way by a decided margin. I know that that doesn't impact the preparation or thought process for this one, but how do you describe the series that you've had with Army and the tone and tenor of the games?
Well, I think anytime you play a service academy, it's really unique. It's special. You know, so when we're up, you know, at West Point, you know, it's a great environment. The games are well attended up there. And, you know, obviously when we go down to the Naval Academy, it's the same thing. And when those teams come to campus, you know what you're going to get when you play a service academy. You're going to get a team that's going to fight for 60 minutes. They're going to compete. They're going to hit you. And it's going to be a battle. And so, you know, really, I have a real, you know, respect when we play those teams, and our team does as well. But you know, it's going to be fireworks. Hopefully, here you know, our students are going to come out and support us and make this a tough place to play.
What have you seen from them on film?
I think they've got some of the best shooters certainly in the league. You know, they're going to be really a difficult team starting at the X. I think it starts there for them. I think their wing play is terrific. I think they're very good. You know, when the whistle blows right there, they're dangerous coming from face-off X to offense. So that's something that we have to kind of get our handle on early in the game. And then you have to settle in and defend shooters. You know, they're good at attack. They're quick. They got a good left-handed shooter. They got a guy at X that can distribute the ball. And, you know, so that's really what we got to do. We got to get down and play 6-on-6 when that opportunity presents itself, and really do a good job of what we call skewering, getting to gloves and disrupting their very talented shooters from the outside. And they shoot with such velocity that, you know, you don't want to give them a lot of free step down looks at your goalie. We're going to have to fly all over the field there. And then, you know, push transition when it's there, but settle into our offensive sets and recognize how Army is defending us. Are they in a zone? Are they in a man? You know, and they've got a very talented goaltender in A.J. Barreto, and, you know, we're going to have to beat him with good smart shots.
Well, Coach Toomey, we really appreciate your time on the Inside the Cross podcast. I want to get you out with one that I would call a little bit lighthearted. You know, you and I have had this conversation where you're unique among your Division I men's head coaching peers as one of the few guys who was a goalie. So I got to imagine that there's a little bit of a, you know, some kind of tinge when you see your goalie put in a goal. What was it like watching him release the ball and seeing it fly into the net last week?
Yeah, I think it was real exciting for the program. You know, I think it was a little bit of wind out of the sails for BU, which we kind of needed in that moment. But it really put a lot of energy into our locker room. And that was one of the first questions I was asked in the post game is, did you ever score? And, you know, it was a quick no, but you know, that's a feather in Jacob's hat, and hopefully we're not going to ask him to do a lot of that. Hopefully we're stopping the ball and letting Pat put it in the net.
Well, once again, appreciate your time. Best of luck as you and your team continue to prepare for Army, and we look forward to watching on Friday.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Marquette head coach Joe Amplo, whose team is coming off of an incredible comeback against Providence for a 12-11 Big East victory last Saturday. Joe, I want to start there. How'd that unfold from your perspective?
I can take no credit for it, honestly. I think a lot of luck involved and just our players' resiliency and probably just assumption at that point in the game with a minute and 36 to down four, their assumption that they're going to lose. So they just play kind of carefree and not reckless, but just with no consequence. We got lucky because Providence made a few critical mistakes and we were fortunate enough to capitalize on them. But I've never seen it before. Blown away by how it happened, truthfully.
And it kind of, in some ways, emblemizes this season. You're 6-5, started 3-0 with a win over Ohio State to end that stretch. And then you dropped 3 in a row, and now you've kind of seesawed back and forth since. How's the season unfolded at large from your perspective?
Well, I never have been a result-oriented person, but I kind of assumed that this was going to be a volatile year. There were going to be moments where we were going to look really good and moments where we were going to look really bad. And that's true. That's true. It's been true in every game where we've had moments. I look back to the Michigan and Robert Morris game where you take 6 minutes and we look like the worst lacrosse team on the planet, you know, and let teams go on 5 and 6 goal runs. And then we look really good against every team we play. So with a youthful team, not a lot of experience, and some freshmen in key positions, we kind of expected the volatility. Luckily for us against Providence, the volatility was on the right side of the equation at the end of the game on Saturday.
You're 5-2 in one-goal games. The simple question is how, particularly given that young teams are supposed to make youthful mistakes down the stretch.
Luck, I think some of our key players are seniors, you know, with Zach Malillo at the faceoff X and Cole Blazer in the goal. Certainly having experience in those two positions really helps in one goal games. That's key. But also, if you look at our history, you know, we almost have as many one goal wins in the history of our program as we do other wins. So we've always managed to be in tight games. And I've been fortunate to be successful in the majority of them. So I think our kids expect that. And I don't want to say like the pressure, but they certainly understand end-of-the-game management for the most part. And they've seen a lot of things that college lacrosse can throw at you in those situations.
John Wagner has 5 game-winning goals. Did I hear correctly? Does he have 5 overtime game-winning goals?
No.
4.
The 4 overtime and the Jacksonville one came with like 14 seconds left. So it's honestly, it's wild. It's wild.
And he's a 6'2", 200-pound attackman from Canada, played his high school lacrosse in Michigan. What more can you tell fans about John Wagner?
He wears really bad shoes during the pregame meal, but he's a great kid. He's a 4.0 student, investment banking major, and does everything on this campus the right way. So I'm proud of him for doing all those things right and then being successful on the lacrosse field.
Turning the attention ahead, take on the Duke Blue Devils, 6 p.m. Friday. This one's available via the Watch ESPN app, ACC Network Extra. What have you seen from Duke on tape?
Everything good. You know, they're a typical Duke team in the middle of April that these kids – this program, Duke, they just continue to get better and improve. There's no better example of trusting a process than the Duke Blue Devils, and they seem to do it every year. I think they're playing at a high level individually and collectively, so I would expect an extreme challenge at every position and from the Dukies on Friday night.
This is an interesting matchup for a couple of reasons. The first is the fact that it's a non-league game in the middle of these highly pressure-packed league matchups, and your familiarity with the opposing coaches. So what's the vibe around the game like relative to what you've been experiencing the last couple weeks and what you will experience again when you head to Denver with respect to your pregame conversation with Coach Dino and Coach Caputo? And then, you know, is there anything about it that's different or unique because of when it falls in the calendar?
You know, it's a great question, Terry, but Dino and I talk almost every other day, and we talk about our teams. We're pretty candid about our teams, truthfully, through the year. I don't think we hide much. I mean, at least I've never played poker with him, so I can't say he's bluffing me. But he's somewhat candid. I think I certainly rely on his advice with my team, but I think he appreciates my insight just talking about coaching. So the conversation through the year is always like that. And I called him on Saturday after their Virginia game. I said, all right, that's it. I'm not going to talk to you until next Friday. But sure enough, Monday morning, we called each other. You know? You know, we're just joking about our teams and about the games. And I said to him, I said, look, just don't make it 10-1 after the first quarter. You know, let's try and keep it close. Just trying to sandbag him a little bit. But I think we both appreciate that. Our teams are competitive. We're blessed to coach great groups. And as I said, I told this to someone else, I said, it's not hard for me to coach against him because I really get an opportunity to enjoy 2 hours of being on a lacrosse field with Coach and Ronnie and Matt and their program.
And not to get past the Duke matchup, which I'm sure is squarely the focus for you and your team, but for your program, a lot of Marquette's identity has been defined in games against, at least from a results perspective, and you've already mentioned that you are not a results-oriented person, so allow me to be, but in terms of these big wins that have come over Denver, so is there anything about this team and realizing what the next 2 week hold in store that frames the conversation as you talk to your squad on a daily basis?
Yeah, in fact, on Monday, the first thing I said to them, I said, look, here's the mission, right? The next 2.5 weeks, we have an opportunity to get better. We have clinched a chance. We've clinched our berth in the Big East tournament. And if we lose sight of the fact that we just have to continue to improve each day, then we're going to miss an opportunity to be at our best, you know, 2 weeks from this Thursday. And that's really what we have to do. Regardless if we play Duke or Denver the next 2 weeks, we can't focus on just them as an opponent. We've got to focus on more what we can do to get better for 2.5 weeks from now. So that on that Thursday afternoon, when we play whoever it is we're going to play, we have prepared our team to be at its best. You know, and look, the result on Friday night is important, and we're going to game plan and want to win. But at the end of the day, if we look back on Friday evening and say, okay, we played better than we did last Saturday, we've got to be happy with that because that's the development of a team that, you know, wants to be playing its best at the end of the year. So there's still a lot of growth to be seen, hopefully, with our group, and we've got to focus on that.
Well, Coach Amplo, we really appreciate your time on the Inside of the Cross podcast. Those of you interested in learning more about the Marquette program, make sure to pick up a copy of the May issue of Inside of the Cross magazine. Matt Kinnear went out and spent a couple days in Milwaukee, got an opportunity to get eyes on a basketball game. You really rolled out the red carpet for him, and we couldn't be more grateful and proud of how the story of the way that your program has come from point A to point Z, or wherever we are in that timeline, to fruition under your supervision.
Thanks, Terry. I appreciate the time.
And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Virginia head coach Lars Tiffany, whose Cavaliers are coming off of a very interesting and kind of wildly unfolding defeat against Duke. And also, you know, I'm thinking back to your win over North Carolina in that, you know, kind of torrential downpour and how meaningful that game was, and squaring their sights on Vermont in a neutral site game this Saturday, 1 p.m. in New Canaan. Lars, how do you characterize the current status of your team as you, you know, take on this non-league game with all this swirling around as far as the ACC tournament and qualification is concerned?
Sure. I have to tell you, I think we had maybe our best practice of the season, if not the year, on Monday. And I was, what a heartening experience. I was very, very happy to see that the 5-goal loss made our men work harder, made them come in more focused on what we call a big Monday, when there's an intense 2-hour practice, a lot of physical play. We had the gauntlet drill out there. We had chuck drill. So we, and they responded. And we followed up with a team lift and film session. So I really like the mindset of this team at this point, especially compared to last year. This team has really taken ownership of knowing that every day we can get better. All coaches say that. And sometimes you're pulling teeth to make it happen. But this team, I really like where we are as we prepare for the Vermont Catamounts.
What is the identity of this team? And I ask it from the mindset of when people outside of your team and program talk about the Cavaliers, they kind of talk about them in two parts, the part of the season that occurred before Ryan Conrad got injured and the part of the season that occurred since. How do you define the identity of this team?
That's a great question. I'm still trying to figure that out, but I don't want to question it too much because this group is, we're finding success, not as much success as I know we all want, but we are improving. And I'm not sure I can say that about all the teams I've coached. This team is truly moving forward and improving. What I'm seeing from this group is a youthful zeal, a true appreciation of being out of practice, of being together, of committing to doing the best they can. And again, this sounds like a lot of coach speak, but I'm really truly seeing it, that they're sharing their voices with each other. They're looking towards each other and drawing strength from each other. So could be a little bit of the experience we have, with a lot of first years, second years, earning most of the meaningful minutes and scoring most of the points. And they're just enjoying the time and not worrying about graduation coming up and not worrying about what's happened in the past. We're making a future here.
Transitioning from 17 to 18, a lot was discussed around the specialty positions. And you have two newcomers that have, carried the lion's share of the load with Alex Rode in net and Justin Schwenk at the faceoff X. How do you characterize their performance at each of those positions?
Well, Justin Schwenk, transferring here from Monmouth, what he was able to do for us this season is exceptional. We've been a team that relied on Jason Murphy a year ago, and without him returning, there was a big question mark of what was going to happen there. Justin Schwenk has given us the ball 6 out of 10 times, and he is his workman-like approach, which I know for most faceoff men, that's what they do. They grind, but he is battling injuries. He is fighting through intense defensive pressure once he picks up the ball, and he's one of the best guys we've had in terms of dealing with pressure, and killing the ball and maintaining possession. So we are so fortunate that he decided to transfer here to Virginia and what he's given us. Obviously, Dom Starge and Mark Van Arsdale on the staff did a great job recruiting some very talented players here, and one of them was Alex Rode. Now, Alex has not been sort of been given the keys to the cage as Schwenk may have been given the assignment to take most of the faceoffs. Alex has been in a battle with Griffin Thompson, and I think the battle, the competition, has only made both of them better. Now, I say that after we probably had our poorest performance and goal in that Duke game, but probably have to give credit to Duke, right? They've got some fantastic offensive players who shoot the ball really hard and with fantastic accuracy as well. But Alex is... his mindset is he wants that starting spot. He wants to maintain it. But what I really love is that him and Griffin are really almost the best of friends. They do a lot of the workouts together. They run together. And so they're pushing each other, even though they're trying to steal each other's jobs.
Is this team playing as fast as you want them to?
I think this team is playing as fast as it can. So to answer your question, no, we're not playing as fast as I want them to. But with the parts that we have, this is about as fast as we can go. So I guess what I'm saying is we're not a Lamborghini. We're a souped up, Mustang. We got a nice, we got some power. We got a powerful engine. We got a bunch of different cylinders. We're not just a 4-cylinder or 6-cylinder, but and so we go, we push, we drive, but it's not easy. we got to really, really drive hard to get the speed we want. And we're just a little bit of youthfulness in the goal, getting that ball up and out in that first outlet pass and finding a fast break. Our D middies are, they're tough. They're tenacious. We're grinders there. You know, maybe necessarily the swiftest or the prettiest. So we're grind there. So, but they have a lot to do with that transition game. And, we probably don't pop the ball forward on the faceoff like we did at Brown those last couple of years of overall. So it's, that's a good question. We're trying and probably playing about as fast as this group as we can with the octane that we have in the fuel tank.
That's a great answer. And you talk about toughness and tenacity at that short 16 midfield position with a youthful team that has to learn a whole new definition of what tough is at the Division I level. How do you and your staff talk to this group about mental toughness and physical toughness and the tenacity that it's required to play?
I love that you've asked that question because we've been attacking this in many ways. And the biggest way we've attacked it is what we've started calling cultural Tuesdays. Every Tuesday, we spend 45 minutes in the life skills room here in U-Haul. And it's a different topic each week. We used a book called Legacy by James Kerr to guide us on four or five of those sessions. And lately, we've been using the book by Stephen Pressfield, Gates of Fire, about the Battle of Thermopylae. The Sparta 300, which the Milton 300 glorified 10 years ago. And the men were assigned this past week, two different small groups of the men, to come up with a theme and present different quotes and concepts of the book to the team. And so the men were doing this to themselves. And one was discipline and one was toughness. So one group focused on discipline and one group focused on toughness and found quotes from that book. And so essentially, we're getting there through what we believe are intense practices, but also talking about it and what it means and what the sacrifice is. If you really value something, you'll sacrifice for it. And so what does that mean, that discipline? And sometimes that toughness is backing down from a fight because we've had a couple of ejections this year. We've got to learn from that. And I really value what we've been doing on those cultural Tuesdays.
And then the last one is just the idea of Vermont. A program under a second-year head coach in Chris Fifes, who is familiar with Virginia, having prepared for them during his tenure at North Carolina and also having played against him as a player. But also, I think of Vermont, which under Ryan Curtis was led by a Virginia alum, as having, some of the fingerprints in conjunction with the fact that, a former Catamount is, now a member of the roster with Cam Stafford having 9 points on the season. So what do you think of this matchup and what have you seen on film as you prepare?
Well, it's a great point what you bring up, Terry. There's a lot more connections between a school in the South and a school on the northern border of this country than one would expect. You just mentioned them. It's interesting. I'm really impressed with what Chris Fifes has done. Wow, just in the second year, the defense they're playing, and they've got a fantastic goalie and what they're doing behind them, what he's bailing them out. But he's got a really nice defense, the way they slide and rotate. And then the offense that they can put up with so many Canadians. And arguably, somebody who, if he's playing in Chapel Hill or Charlottesville, he's a household name. Ian McKay is, incredible. I mean, that what he does on film, we've been watching all week, and there's been more oohs and ahs by our defense in film than I'm comfortable with watching things he does. and there's been more oohs and ahs for things he does than some of the best players we've played already this season. He's got a nice supporting cast. And again, a brother of a former Virginia lacrosse player, Joe French, and is starting on attack for him. So they're talented. Ryan Curtis set the table here. I think they did a really nice job with the recruiting in the last few years of his tenure at Vermont. And then Chris Fifes, boy, he's injected a whole lot of optimism, positive mindset, and some really good coaching.
Well, Lars, we really appreciate your time on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Safe travels to Connecticut. Best of luck as you and your squad continue to prepare. We look forward to watching this one and look forward to watching the rest of the season.
Hey, it was great to be on. Thanks, Terry.
Terry, a couple things about Andy Shea that I think are worth mentioning. Mechanical engineering background. So he really looks at things a little differently, and spending time with him at practice, as I did when I was up in Connecticut for the hockey regionals, you know, we talked about shooting mechanics and how far the hand should be apart. We talked about the hips and the feet and angles when shooters are shooting alley dodges or cutting across the middle. So there's a level of science to everything he does. I was really impressed. I also think he's an innovator, you know, with their head sleeves that they make their defense wear, where it cuts off their peripheral vision. It really makes them talk and communicate, and their mouths really become the eyes for their teammates, and it ties those six defenders together because they can't see as well, quite honestly, and they're really reliant on one another. So he's an innovator. He looks at things a little differently, and I really enjoyed my time with that program. I thought I benefited dramatically from listening to some of his ideas.
I wonder if you can pick up a head sleeve on Sideline Swap. Sideline Swap is where lacrosse players buy and sell their gear. Shop heads, helmets, shafts, and gloves up to 70% off, or snag hard-to-find college gear. All purchases are backed by Sideline Swap's buyer guarantee. Head to Sideline Swap, that's SideLineSwap.com, or download the iPhone app today. Do you have any comments on your recent exposure experiences or relationships with Joe Amplo, Charlie Toomey, or Lars Tiffany?
Oh no, they're all fascinating. They're all fascinating studies. You know, Lars' background on the farm up there in Central New York, and then Charlie Toomey, having played for Coach Shriver at BL, and then you know we were the same class when he was at Loyola, and I was always amazed at the confidence and the attitude that Charlie brought to the field. I got in a discussion with Kevin Corrigan about body language today, and how important it is for players, especially if they're leaders of their team. Or viewed as players of you know notable players, let's say, you know, your body language, whether you're having success or failure, is critical. Your teammates are feeding off of you, and I always thought Charlie was really well aware of that. Whether he was having a great day between the pipes or a bad day, you couldn't tell the difference. He was always with that chest puffed up and bouncing around, and I always admired his ability to do that.
Moving ahead to this weekend, it is the best Friday of the season so far. We got to come up with a name for this one. And not only that, but also this is the first of three Fridays that are going to be great, because the following week we've got the ACC and Patriot League semifinals, and then the week after we've got a couple other league semifinals, I believe, the Ivy League
Patriots Day. Patriots Day.
That's right.
I was with Evan Washburn last night. He's going to be broadcasting the Patriot League championships and also the Big East back-to-back weeks, and he's eager. You know, he called that Army-Navy game. He really felt that Navy was fortunate to win the game, the controversial goal before halftime, and then Army just didn't shoot well. Navy made too many stops. But, you know, Navy will either host, or if Loyola beats Army on Friday night, Loyola is the host to that Patriot League tournament. And it's going to be a fascinating tournament because Loyola looks like they're in. And outside of that, it could be a three-bid league. It could be a one-bid league.
I totally agree. And when you look at the recent history of Loyola versus Army, they have played four times in the past 2 years, and the closest margin of victory was, I believe, six goals. Loyola has won all four, and I don't know. This is a Black Knight team that has its back against the wall, no doubt about it. It's I believe they're a win-and-in situation and a lose-and-they're-out.
Yeah, their playoff start. Playoff start, just like North Carolina, you know, first playoff game. This is a playoff game for Army. They're playing postseason lacrosse on April 21st.
Are they good enough to beat a Loyola team that put up 16 on Lehigh and 23 on Boston University?
I'd be inclined to say no, but you know, you think about the way they started their season with that win over Rutgers. I think they're 2-6 since then. They've really struggled. They didn't make a save in the second half last week. So I'm inclined to go with a Loyola team that's playing really well. You got Minsloff and Begley, they're shorties. I like Foster Huggins was drafted, senior defender. And then Spencer. You know, Pat Spencer will be the number one pick in the 2019 MLL draft, and he is just tearing it up.
Not be true. I picked this up from Evan on the Lehigh broadcast, and apparently he is very seriously considering using a fifth year of eligibility to play basketball.
Well, that's fine because he'd still be drafted. But I hope he does play basketball because you don't get that opportunity once you send it in. But when he decides to play pro lacrosse, he's the number one draft choice. That's apparent, and people are trying to stockpile. But getting back to that matchup, you know, I don't see Navy winning the Patriot League this year. I think they've been really fortunate to win some of the games they have. I think the champion is coming from the Loyola would be the number one choice. Bucknell would be two. Army would actually be three, and Navy would be four.
Wow!
If I had to handicap the race.
Interesting. Okay, so you're saying Army could go from not getting in to like competing for a championship, and
they could.
And certainly, has happened with the Black Knights in the past.
Well, a win over Loyola, they would catch fire, you know, and they'd enter the tournament with momentum, and they'd be on a mission.
That game, 7 p.m. Friday night, CBS Sports Network. Two other games of note. Albany in their America East matchup. They're coming off a 13-day break, and they take on the Binghamton Bearcats in the Capital Region. That game is also a 7 p.m. start. And then Duke versus Marquette, the battle of Hempstead Turnpike via the Milwaukee Turnpike, I don't even know what that's called, and then Tobacco Road as Coach Joe Amplo takes on Coach John Donosky. We just heard him talk about the dynamic of this matchup as far as their relationship is concerned. Like I said at the top, great Friday of lacrosse. A lot of MAC taking place. Those games start at 4 p.m., so make sure you check out Inside Lacrosse, the epic scoreboard, to see more about.
Yeah, Albany's weekend is going to be fascinating.
You know what they're going to need? They're going to need Trimino.
They are, you know, Kyle McClancy definitely needs Trimino when things get heated up.
Protein infused water has 7 grams of whey protein and essential B vitamins to fuel your game. Ideal before, during, or after your workout. Hydrate with a beverage as versatile as you are. Play hard, not hungry. Protein is always an important part of any athlete's diet. Supplement yours with excess calories and without excess calories and fat. If you get the excess calories and fat in there, whatever, it's excess. You shouldn't be having that. Go beyond hydration with protein-infused water via Trimino. 7 grams of whey protein. What about the Dane Train? What do you got?
The Dane Train needs to get on their Trimino, and they need to get healthy, number one. Number two, they got to play better this weekend. You know, there's a high confidence in them making it to the semifinals in Gillette. You know, I posted that poll on Twitter last week, and they won by a landslide in terms of people thinking that they're going to make a run here for this whole thing. They're not playing that well lately. They've had the time off. You get Binghamton as a little tune-up. You got to come back on Sunday, 1 o'clock, ESPN3. You can watch that game on ESPNU. It's 6 o'clock Sunday night. It's Yale and Albany. I think it's one of the most important games of the entire season. I really do. It's a non-conference game, maybe between two AQ winners. It's going to really set things up RPI-wise. It's going to set up Albany as a number one seed or not. Albany loses that game. How far do they drop? Does Yale actually leapfrog them? Do others leapfrog them? That game to me is such a crystallizing game in terms of NCAA tournament.
Handsome Dan is the name of Yale's mascot. I don't know if Albany actually has a Great Dane, and if they do, if he has a name. I think they just are referred to as Scooby. What flavor do you think Handsome Dan would gravitate toward? Coconut, pineapple,
peach? I think he
likes
Orchard.
You like? Yeah, okay. I can see that.
I'm pushing the Orchard. Yale's got 6 seniors. All of them got drafted in Major League Lacrosse. People have been laughing at me all year. I get heckled on Twitter about my support of this Yale program, but I honestly, they had 6 seniors drafted. Okay, how many did Syracuse have?
0.
Close your eyes. What do you see?
0.
Yeah. That's why they're legit, because your seniors have to play well late April and into May.
Protein never tasted so good. Well, you've trampled all over the rundown, but let's talk a little bit about Saturday before opening up that conversation with respect to the Great Danes and the Bulldogs. You mentioned all the uncertainty around the ACC tournament selection criteria. A lot of off-the-record conversations I'm sure you've had. I think some folks in the Inside Lacrosse office have had as well. We're waiting some finality and certainty, and hopefully by the time you're listening to this podcast, we understand it. How do you summarize? Yeah. Can you summarize at all what the lack of clarity is? Like, without divulging anything?
I think the criteria wasn't communicated accurately to both the media and certain coaching staffs, and we'll see how that goes. We should have been given a clearer picture and a more simplistic picture as to what the tie-breaking is. It's not the first, second. I think it's the third criteria. I don't like it. I think it's a lame criteria. We talked about this already, how you know,
not on the podcast.
How goals against encourages slow play.
The tiebreaker
and how a team, as you said, benefits. Notre Dame benefits by losing to Duke 8-2, when Virginia actually is more severely hurt by losing to Duke 18-11 when the score was 12-11 in the fourth quarter. Like, they were going for it. They're trying to win. You know, it's just such a lame criteria.
Not to mention, you made a really good point, which is that the league benefits by putting its most tournament qualified team forward. And since RPI is such an important tournament qualifier, why not use RPI as a good tiebreaker? But for me, the thing that's most important about the criteria is that it should only incorporate the tied teams. I don't know for certain that the criteria incorporates all five teams, but that's because I don't know if anybody knows for certain what the criteria is, and I know that one version of it that's been communicated incorporates all five teams, and I just don't think that the performance against any of the non-tied teams, Duke and Syracuse in this case, it really warrants consideration. I think it should be solved by the riddle of those three tied teams.
Yeah, and with that in mind, Notre Dame plays Carolina on Saturday at noon, in a game for North Carolina that is an absolute playoff game. Okay, they lose, their season's over. They don't have a game the following weekend. Can you imagine their season being over on April 21st? That in itself, you know, just stands out. So they're on this massive losing streak, Terry. They've got some injuries to deal with. They've had success against Notre Dame scoring better than a lot of other teams in the ACC, quite frankly. If you look back at some of the scores in the series, you know, Carolina has managed to score an early offense, transition goals, some face-off goals, maybe a little riding, and they've done very well on extra man. For whatever reason, Dave Metzbauer has a better vision of how to attack Notre Dame's half-field defense than most. He mixes it up. You'll see some invert, low wing. You'll see very little dodging from up, you know, an umbrella up top, because that really feeds into the way Notre Dame plays defense. So there is hope for this Carolina team. They're all of a sudden very young in the midfield, a lot of new faces. You know, Gavin O'Connell's going to face off. Interesting that he's a lefty. And then you got Notre Dame. You know, they were off last weekend, and Coach Corgan actually gave them a lot of time off. They had Thursday off after that Marquette win. Friday they did stick work, light. And then they're off Saturday and Sunday, so they should be fresh. Costabile and Gleason still are, you know, I've got to call them game time decision type injuries. We're not sure.
Well, Costabile played against Marquette. Is it possible that he would be out after coming back?
Potentially, yeah.
Wow.
You know, he's. I don't think he's 100%. Let's just put it that way. So that extra time, that rest, that could be a reset button. But maybe these teams have checked out. I don't know. This is a really interesting game, because sometimes when you're on one, when there's such negativity around the program, it's hard to restart it. But sometimes that time off is the best thing for you. So I don't know what to think. Notre Dame's playing in such low possession games. What was it, 51 possessions in that Marquette game? They're being held now to like 20 or 25 possessions a game offensively, because teams are holding the ball against them and their defense is so good. And without their best two Dodgers, you know, It's been rough. Garnsey and Wynn are in massive shooting slumps. Their scoring in the ACC is less than five goals a game, basically. So this is a trying time for Coach Corgan and his offensive staff.
You mentioned the history, the recent history, the ACC history of this series, and I want to dive in with a few particular examples, because it's one of the sneaky best series and rivalries in recent years, and I think it's because of the time in the calendar that it falls. Like, this weekend actually ends up being relatively forgettable, because we so quickly fast forward to all the drama of the next 2 weeks of conference tournaments, and then obviously the following 3 weeks of the NCAA tournament. But it was in 2015 when, and you might be able to remember this better than I do, North Carolina was leading Notre Dame in South Bend. I believe it was 14-12, and the Irish scored three goals in the last roughly 90 seconds, including that big penalty against Kavanaugh,
yeah,
where he hit his head on the goalpost, and there was conversation about whether or not he should have been allowed to continue and everything else that went along with that.
Epic with a capital E. One of the better, one of the craziest finishes ever.
Yep.
And then they come right back. Give me the next story.
All right, so hold on. They in 15?
Yeah.
Yeah, so what are you talking about? Because they didn't play again in 15.
No, the next year.
Oh, right.
It was another crazy
game. No. I was going to save that one for last. I'm going to go to last year now and say that in 2017, they played twice. So the Tar Heels go back to South Bend. They lose 14-13. And then in their fateful winning you're in, losing you're out game, you have this epic comeback in the ACC semifinals and win 16-15. They jump all over the Fighting Irish and hold on to win 14-10 to punch their ticket back into the NCAA tournament. But yes, it's the 2016 game that I want to focus on for the purposes of this conversation, because that was the one where it was the goal before halftime. Drew Shantz scored a half field goal right before halftime, and then it sparked like an epic North Carolina comeback in Chapel Hill. And then one that a lot of people forget is that these two teams played at Ohio State in the NCAA quarterfinals, and that was the pivotal moment. That was the one where the team visited Michael Brushy's gravesite. They got over the quarterfinal hump back to the Final Four, and it was not competitive. You know, that sparked what has now been a 2-year run of Notre Dame getting eliminated from the tournament in non-competitive games. So, you know, over the last 3 years, this has been an epic showdown.
Those were amazing games, and I think I was involved with calling at least two of the three. The one comeback in Chapel Hill I did not call. That was Anish, and I remember how tired Notre Dame looked at the end of that game as Caroline and Stephen Kelly were winning every faceoff. I thought the Heels last week, you know, in that loss to Syracuse, they played more man-to-man defense than I ever expected. I thought they were going to sit in the zone the whole game. But by the end of the game, they weren't sliding well. You know, they slid late to Curry. Then they slid to his eyes in overtime for the easy layup. So, you know, the timing of the slides with their man-to-man defense has been an issue. You know, do you sit in zone against Notre Dame, or do you take your chances that you can play man? I'm not sure. Coach Brescia's got the answers. He'll be ready. And you know, this could be our last game that we'll televise Chris Cloutier. Senior, he has been a joy for us to cover. He's been eye candy for the viewer at home. He's delivered so many different times. I can't, you know, it's not like he was a flash in the pan with these one-handed shots. And so, you know, we have tremendous respect for him, and he's been fun to cover.
Yeah, Kirk ran a mile against him. One note for the listener is last night, Chapter 7 of the season 2018 aired Under Pressure. You'll see Cloutier at his emotional appeal to his teammates in the Virginia game. And it was really impressive. It was a side of him that I hadn't seen before. And it was really interesting to behold.
When's it on next, Terry? I missed it.
It'll be available on theseason2018.com on Monday. As far as re-air dates, check the season 2018's Twitter feed. That'll be the easiest place to find when it'll be re-airing on ESPNU. Couple other games of note on Saturday, 1 p.m. CBS Sports Network, the Denver Pioneers head to the Providence Friars. An opportunity to see Trevor Baptiste. You absolutely want to get eyes on that if possible. An interesting out-of-conference game is Vermont versus Virginia. That's 1 p.m. The IMLCA Game of the Week, that's part of a doubleheader in New Canaan, Connecticut, as the New Canaan High School team takes on St. Anthony's in the other half of the doubleheader. And then a renewal of a game that was so many young fans' reason for falling in love with lacrosse was the 2004 National Championship game. Syracuse versus Navy, that one is on at 2 p.m. on Saturday. That doesn't mean the weekend is over, Quint. You talked about
I got action on Sunday. I got action on Sunday.
Meaningful games on Sunday.
John Tillman complaining about playing on like three straight Sundays. Said the kids are denied an opportunity to go out on Saturday night. I almost laughed on my phone. John Tillman said he wants his kids to have that college experience of going out on Saturday night and being able to go to Sunday brunch with their families.
Are you serious?
I am serious. I nearly fainted when he said that on our conference call today.
Do you think,
complaining about, well, it's a different schedule.
Yeah.
It's a different schedule. And the student athletes are, you know, I think the Sunday time slot is nice. I think it works great. No offense, the BTN, they're a competitor of mine. And they got a lot of eyes in those games. It's been a great strategic move. But to have a team play consecutive 3-in-a-row Sundays, it is a little bit different of a dynamic schedule-wise.
Ohio State comes to College Park, 2 p.m., ESPNU. Not a playoff game yet for the Buckeyes, but if they lose, then it turns Rutgers into one in their regular season finale. Have you seen anything out of Ohio State that makes you feel like they can compete?
Yes. Well, I liked what I saw against Michigan because they just refused to lose to the Wolverines. Now it's 7 in a row. Okay, I watched the Maryland-Rutgers game, and Maryland played a great first quarter. Then they played a horrendous, as Coach Tillman said, the worst quarter they've played all season was that second quarter with penalties. And Rutgers really could have finished them off. And there's three things that stand out for Maryland out of that game. Clearing issues, okay? They had 3 failed clears that the ball got shoved right down their throat for Rutgers goals. Okay, that can't happen going forward. Invert defense. Okay, when they go that 1-3-1, that invert zone, they gave up 3 or 4 goals in that game because guys just stand around covering grass. You may be in an invert zone, but you got to play somebody. And Rutgers had a lot of success with single and double inverts, and we know Ohio State will have that up their sleeve. And then the last thing is reliance on attackman Connor Kelly. You know, again, 4-4. One of these days, someone's going to face guard him and hold him to less than 3 points. I mean, he was fantastic. The passing, the shooting, the dodging, just blown away by what he can do. And Coach Tillman saying he can morph into anything you want. And that's such a great quote because we've seen him as a step down shooter. We've seen him as a dodger against shorties early on in his career. Now he's becoming this passer where he's skipping the ball through defenses like he's got X-ray vision. And so it's great to watch. And the only debate we got in with Coach Tillman today was, is he an attackman or is he a middie? He's an attackman by definition, absolutely positively. I understand why Maryland wants to keep him listed as a midfielder because the McLaughlin Award is his for the taking without even a vote. If he's an attackman, all of a sudden he's head-to-head with Gutterding, Reeves, and Fields for any kind of honor. So that's why Maryland is trying to keep him at midfield. That's not coming from their coach. That's coming from my opinion.
7 p.m. Big Ten Network, Penn State at Rutgers. If you're lining up, who is whose rival among the 6 Big Ten lacrosse teams? These should be each other's rivals. And they're both in relatively interesting positions. Penn State just continues to roll. Rutgers, you know, a dominant win over Michigan sandwich between losses to Johns Hopkins and Maryland that has to leave an incredibly bitter taste in their mouths. For Rutgers, you want to win this game and give yourself a little bit of insurance heading into that Ohio State game.
Well, Jules Henningberg has become the story for Rutgers, drafted highly in Major League Lacrosse the other day in the first round by Florida, pick number 7, I believe. He has taken a situation offensively and just said, you know what, this is my team. I'm the guy, and he has scored dozens of unassisted goals this year. He ran through Syracuse like there was nobody there. He dusted Foley of Hopkins a couple times, so that's why he was viewed so highly. I saw some analytics. MLL coaches want guys at the college level who can score unassisted goals. It shows a level of dominance of ability with the ball in their stick that they want to see. He rated extremely high in that category. And he's done a fine job. Now, Penn State, have you watched any of their recent games?
Yeah, I watched the Hopkins game. And I want to start with Gerard Arceri, man.
Well, that offense is sick.
But It is. But can we just give a lot of credit to a kid who was playing with a fake hamstring? Did you hear about this? Colin Dan talked about it on the In the Crease podcast, that apparently this is similar to what Alex Woodall strapped on his leg at the end of the season last year. And for him, the thing about it that struck me was Hopkins threw a long pull out. I mean, Hopkins came into this game with Hunter Moreland being a borderline All-American, and they had a long pull taken like the 6th faceoff of the game. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, you know, I've been calling for that all year. Prouty, how he did not get enough reps early on. And, you know, Moreland's not the answer when the weather heats up and you're going to need a second guy. You'd like the pull to be your third option, but Hopkins' wing play is not on par with what we've seen from some other teams. I think Duke has really good wing play. I love Notre Dame's wing play. You know, when you think about a guy like Travis Anno, but going back to Penn State, wonderful, wonderful off ball movement and Nick Spillane and Mac O'Keefe. And all of a sudden, man, they're scoring, they're getting 12 goals on everybody. That's a dangerous team catching, you know, momentum. I think the three most interesting teams to watch over the next week or two are Penn State, Rutgers, and Virginia. You know, all 3 could miss the playoffs. all three could make the playoffs. So those are fascinating teams to be involved with right now.
And then we're going to end the podcast by talking about a game that we've already kind of talked about twice, not counting our interview with Andy Shea. It is a game that is live on Watch ESPN, 1 p.m. Sunday. Albany heads to New Haven to take on the Yale Bulldogs. Tape delay, 6 p.m. ESPNU. Where does this one start and end for you with respect to each end of the field? Does it, you know, Albany's defense shutting down?
Yeah, possessions. I think it comes down to possessions first. Connor Mackey against TD. Who wins that battle? You know, you got to favor Colarusso in the battle of the two goalies. I think Reeves can have success. But I also think that Connor Fields, if he's healthy, and Justin Ray, if he's healthy, can get things going. So I expect a nice tempo. I expect both teams to get into double digits. You know, the dynamic here of interest is, what do you do if you're Albany? Like, you had your time off, how'd you use it? And then you have a game 2 days in front of this, a little tune-up, Binghamton. So you know, that's the interesting thing. And then you're on the road. So great game, huge ramifications for both teams in terms of the NCAA playoffs. I see, at the beginning of the year, I had those two teams advancing to Gillette. And I'm not sure that's going to be possible now. But, you know, these are two teams that way back when, you know, in September, I thought they both could be top four teams.
I think it's possible. Are you saying that because you think that it's likely they'd be seated on the same side of the bracket, or do you just think that it's unlikely that both will be of
well,
the four?
Well, someone's going to lose this game.
Yeah,
and then, you know, Yale still has to deal with Cornell and others in the Ivy League. So I don't know how it's going to break down.
Sure.
I mean, Yale's in a situation where they could move probably as high as a 2 seed, or they could be on the road in the first round.
I agree with that. I still wouldn't bet against the notion that these two teams are going to be in Foxborough. Now, I don't know if I would bet for it, but I think that there's reasons for optimism if that's what you're cheering for. For me, one of the matchups I'm interested in watching closely is presumably Chris Fake, who has guarded most opponents' number ones so far this season, guarding Connor Fields. Obviously, Fields' health remains a question mark and a mystery, so it'll be fascinating to see how that unfolds. But this one's going to be a good one, and you're not wrong to say that from the opening faceoff and how TD matches up against Connor Mackey, you know, it'll certainly
talent.
Be a battle.
Yeah, a lot of talent, Terry. I mean, as I said earlier, Yale had six seniors drafted. Albany had four. Plus, you got you got De Hoga, underclassman, TD, underclassman. You know, Yale's got a bunch of talent. There's a lot of talent on the field. And again, I think these two teams are destined for greatness. I don't know how the loser reacts here. That's the only question.
All right, well, Quint, well, that'll do it for this edition of the Inside Lacrosse Weekend Preview Podcast. Thank you to our sponsors, Sideline Swap and Trimino. Download the Sideline Swap app. Head to CVS or Amazon to pick up your Trimino. Thank you to our guests. And as always, you can leave a rating and review on iTunes. Quint, thank you for your time. Follow Quint on Twitter, at QKesnick, on Instagram, at QEKesnick. And make sure to visit InsideLacrosse.com and the Epic Isle scoreboard all weekend for the latest and greatest in the Inside Lacrosse landscape and D1 action.
Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.